With infinite complacence, people went to and fro over the earth about their little affairs, serene in the assurance of their dominion over this small, spinning fragment of solar driftwood, which by chance or design, man has inherited out of the dark mystery of time and space.
Why don't you ask me what it feels like to be a freak?
The power of a new generation.
Everyone here is mad.
Greetings, and you are listening to Savage Science Radio here at Jackalope 105 FM, and I am your host, Tracy Savage. Let's get tonight started off with some tunes.
We'll be right back.
And apparently the bell is tolling for a whole bunch of people, according to a U.S. preacher that's warning that the end of the world is nigh on the 21st of May around 6 p.m. to be precise. Although he has been wrong before, he says he's not wrong this time, and we're assuming that 6 p.m. would be Pacific Standard Time because this dude is out of Oakland, California. He's a preacher. He's been talking about the rapture, and he says only about 2% of the world's population are going to make it, you know, to heaven, and the rest of us are going to get to go to the other place, wherever that is, and then still, even more people are going to be eternally dead. Now, when I'm talking about eternally dead, Harold Camping, this preacher who's got tons of money wrapped up in his radio station, and I assume that this is a huge ploy to get even more listeners than he already has, but people are actually giving up their life savings to buy billboards because they bought into this guy's stuff. Now, say he's right, all right? He says he's done this big mathematical process, and he's got the actual day, and that he says that the 21st of May is 722,500 days from the 1st of April AD 33. Now see, that he believes this is the date of the crucifixion, and the figure of 722,500 is important because you get it by multiplying three holy numbers, 5, 10, and 17. 17. Okay, well, you know, he is a preacher. I'm not. I don't know where 17 came from, but that's what he says. Together twice. When I found this out, I tell you, it blew my mind, he said. Well, it's blowing my mind, too. And if he is right, you know what you're going to need? You're going to need people like me. People who watch zombie films. Because if you're like I am, you're not going to be going with this guy. You're going to be stuck on the earth with the eternally dead. And they're going to be running around and they're going to want to eat your brains. So guess what? We're going to have some timely tips for you so that you can be prepared for the zombie apocalypse. And if you don't believe me, just ask Harold, because you're probably not going to be in the 2% either. Now, what would we do? We would rationally turn to science for the answers. An airborne virus is rapidly turning people into zombies. 2/3 of humanity has been wiped out. Scientists desperately look for a cure, even as their own brains deteriorate and the disease robs them of what we consider life. Relax. It's only fiction. Well, at least for now. This apocalyptic scenario frames a new novel, The Zombie Autopsies, by Dr. Steven Schlossman, a child psychologist who holds positions at Harvard Medical School and the Massachusetts General Hospital McLean Program in Child Psychiatry. Well, that's kind of an interesting field. Child psychiatry, and he is a zombie fan. Cool. You might not expect someone with those credentials to take a zombie seriously, but it turns out the undead are a great way to explore real-world health issues, why certain nasty diseases can destroy the brain, how global pandemics create chaos and fear, and what should be done about people infected with a highly contagious and incurable lethal illness. One of the things zombie novels do is they bring up all these essential concerns that happen in medicine all the time. How do you define what's alive, says Schlossman, who's been known to bounce between zombie fan conventions and academic meetings. When is it appropriate to say someone's as good as dead, which is an awful difficult decision? Now, what a zombie virus could do to the brain? Well, so maybe you've seen Night of the Living Dead or read World War Z or can't wait for the return of the AMC show The Walking Dead, but you probably don't know what differentiates the brains of humans and zombies, and we're going to tell you. First things first, how does the zombie disease infect its victims? Well, many stories in the genre talk about biting, but Schlossman's novel imagines a deliberately engineered virus whose particles can travel in the air and remain potent enough to jump from one person to another in a single sneeze. Yes, I said a sneeze. Now, then to the brain eating. The zombie virus, as Schlossman describes it, basically gnaws the brain down to the amygdala, which is the almond-shaped structure responsible for the fight-or-flight response. The zombies always respond by fighting because another critical part of the brain, the ventromedial hypothalamus, which tells you when you've eaten enough, is completely broken. Now, the brain's frontal lobes, responsible for problem solving, are devoured by the virus, so zombies can't make complex decisions, as we all know. Impairment in the cerebellum means they can't walk well either, which is kind of why they amble around. So, these humanoids have an unexpected predilection for eating human flesh as well. The zombies in this book are stumbling, shambling, hungry as hell, Schlossman says. Basically, they're like drunk crocodiles. They're not smart. They don't know who you are or what you are. And how a zombie virus would be made? Well, so the bloodthirsty undead wander or crawl, I guess, around spreading a lethal illness ominously called ataxic neurodegenerative satiety deficiency syndrome, or ANSD for short, which is a lot shorter. When something really terrifying comes along, especially in medicine, or that has a medical feel to it, we always give it initials. Well, of course, because, you know, it makes it more important. And that's the way we distance ourselves from it, Schlossman says. It also saves time in conversation, as far as I'm concerned. But the virus has several brain-destroying components, one of which is a prion. Now, this is a protein like the one that causes mad cow disease. In real life, prions twist, and when they are in an acidic environment, they become dangerous. Now, Schlossman says how our own environment has changed to make prions infectious, getting from the soil to the cows, and mad cow disease, for instance, is a mystery. Now, here's something to send some chills up your spine. In Schlossman's world, airborne prions can be infectious, meaning mad cow disease and similar nervous system destroyers could theoretically spread just like the flu. Swiss and German researchers recently found out that mice that only had 1 minute of exposure to aerosols containing prions died of mad cow disease, as reported in the journal PLOS Pathogens. A follow-up, described in the Journal of American Medical Association, showed that the same for a related disease that's only found in animals called scrapie. Now, of course, these are mice in artificially controlled conditions in a laboratory, and humans do not exhale prions, but it could have implications for safety practices nonetheless. Like mad cow disease, the zombie disease Schlossman describes also progresses in acidic environments. Now, in the book, a major corporation doles out implantable meters that infuse the body with chemicals to artificially lower acidity when it gets too high. But sadly, when acidity is too low, that also induces symptoms that mimic the zombie virus, so it's not a long-term solution. Everyone who gets exposed eventually succumbs, Schlossman says. Now, as for the unknown component of the zombie disease that would help slowly zombifying researchers in their quest for a cure, that's up for the reader to figure out, and the clues are all in the book, Schlossman says. Now, how would we fight back? You can't ethically round up fellow survivors to kick some zombie butt unless the undead have technically, you know, died. In Schlossman's book, a group of religious leaders get together and decide that when people reach stage 4 of the disease, they're basically dead. That, of course, permits zombie deanimation, or killing, in other words. Now, how do you kill a zombie? Much of zombie fiction knocks out the zombies through shots to the head. You know, that's pretty well known. That, Schlossman says, is because the brainstem governs the most basic functioning, breathing and heartbeat. A zombie apocalypse disease, like the one he describes, probably wouldn't evolve on its own in the real world, he said, but as we've seen, individual symptoms of zombies do correspond to real ailments. If they all came together, the disease would be creepily efficient at claiming bodies, Schlossman says. Now, bad news, folks? Well, actually, it would be worse news because it's been pretty bad news up till now. Even if people contracted a zombie virus through the bites, the odds of our survival aren't all that great. A mathematician at the University of Ottawa named Robert Smith has calculated that if one zombie were introduced to a city of 500,000 people, after about 7 days, every human would either be dead or a zombie. We're in big, big trouble if this ever happens, Smith said. We can kill the zombies a bit, but we're not very good at killing zombies fundamentally. What tends to happen is the zombies just win, and the more they win, the more they just keep winning because the disease spreads so rapidly. Now, the best solution is a strategic attack rather than an every-man-for-himself defense scenario, he said. It would take knowledge and intelligence, neither of which zombies have, to prevail. Why study zombies? Well, in his day job, Smith models how real infectious diseases spread, because he's already reaped benefits from his own work on zombies. For instance, while many mathematical models only deal with one complicated aspect of a situation at a time, he tackled two, zombie infection and zombie killing, when it came to speculating about outbreaks. When it came time for modeling of real-world human diseases like HPV, then Smith felt equipped to handle many facets of it at the same time, such as heterosexual and homosexual transmission of HPV. Knowing what we knew from zombies allowed us to actually take on these more complicated models without fear, he said. Studying zombies is also a great way to get young people excited about science. Smith, who was on a zombie science panel with Schlossman through the National Academy of Sciences Science and Entertainment Exchange in 2009, he has also seen math-phobic people get interested in mathematics by reading about his work with zombies. There are insights that we gain from the movies, from fiction, and from fun popular culture stuff that actually can really help us think about the way that science works, and also the way science is communicated, he said. And as to why people like reading about zombies and watching zombies so much, Schlossman points out to the impersonal nature of things in our society, from waiting in line at the DMV to being placed on hold on a call with a health insurance company. Think about all the situations in daily life where you sense a general lack of respect for humanity, and zombies make a little more sense. Now, the zombies themselves represent a kind of commentary on modernity, Schlossman says. We're increasingly disconnected. That might be the current appeal. And if you'd like to get more in depth with Dr. Steven Schlossman's book, it's called The Zombie Autopsies, and it's available in a bookstore near you.
Yeah.
This might sound like a lot of fun and joking around, but zombies are real in nature. Let me tell you about a few of the parasites that are found in ant bodies that tell us Hollywood stories of the undead may be closer to truth than fiction. Now, once the fungus invades the victim's body, it's already too late. The invader spreads through the host in a matter of days. The victim, unaware of what's happening, becomes driven to climb to a high spot. Just before dying, the infected body, a zombie, grasps a perch as the mature fungal invader erupts from the back of the zombie's head to rain down spores on unsuspecting victims below, starting the cycle all over again. This isn't the latest gross-out moment from a George A. Romero horror film. It's part of a very real evolutionary arms race between a parasitic fungus and its victims, ants. One zombie by itself is not necessarily very scary, but in B-movies from Night of the Living Dead to Zombieland, Hollywood's animated corpses have a nasty habit of creating more of the walking dead. Controlled by some inexplicable force, perhaps an intensely virulent pathogen, the main preoccupation of a zombie is making other zombies. Pretty much. The storyline is pure drive-in movie schlock, yet the popular mythology of zombies has lately been spattered with a coating of biological truth. There actually are organisms that have evolved to control the minds and bodies of other creatures, turning once normal individuals into dazed victims that fulfill the parasite's need to reproduce itself. Some of the most successful zombie masters are fungi from the genus Ophiocordyceps. Now, these parasites infest many kinds of arthropods, from butterflies to cockroaches, but it's among the ants that the fungi's ability to control other beings' behavior is most apparent. One prototypical scenario is found in Costa Rica, where infected bullet ants, also known as Paraponura clavata, climb to a great spore-sprinkling height just before the fungus erupts, like I just described before. In the jungles of Thailand, the fungus Ophiocordyceps unilaterius parasitizes Campanitis leonardi ants, which forage on the ground and nest in the canopy. When infected, these ants shamble toward the ant graveyards, quote-unquote, where they bite down on the undersides of leaves, anchoring their fungus-infected husks at a level of the forest just within the right humidity and temperature to allow the fungus to grow properly. Now, when Sander Anderson of the University of Copenhagen and colleagues placed the bodies of infected ants higher in the canopy, the parasites grew abnormally, and infested ants placed on the ground were eaten by other insects. The fungus is sensitive to UV light, and heavy rainfall in a tropical forest would most likely be able to damage the fungus. Anderson says the position of the ant on the underside of the leaf limits the exposure of the parasite. The fungus drives the ants to seek out specific places to die that best benefit the growth of the fungus. Ophiocordyceps-like parasites have been manipulating other organisms for millions of years. Their disturbing behavior has been preserved in the fossil record. 48 million years ago, during the global hothouse epoch of the Eocene, The place now known as Messel, Germany, was draped in a lush semi-tropical forest. Archaic primates scrambled among the trees, cousins of early horses browsed, and an Ophiocordyceps-like fungus caused ants to put a death grip on leaves just before the infesting fungus fully overran their bodies. Exceptionally preserved fossil leaves from the Messel quarry show the same pattern of leaf scars made by some living ant species when they have become fungus-controlled zombies. Scientists are looking for these types of interactions even farther back in time. Now that we know the behavior like this can fossilize, I would not be surprised if we find more, says University of Exeter behavioral ecologist David Hughes. I believe samples tens of millions of years older are likely, he said. Now, the fungus is clearly ancient. In 2008, another team announced that a 105-million-year-old insect trapped in amber was shot through with an Ophiocordyceps-like fungus. It is possible that zombie-style parasitism between fungus and its hosts goes back all the way to the Cretaceous days of the dinosaurs, although evidence of zombie dinosaurs has not been forthcoming. Fungi are not the only parasites to hijack ants. A different kind of parasite changes the appearance of giant gliding ants, Cephalotes tritus, from Central and South America. Now, while studying this ant species in Panama, Stephen Yanovayak of the University of Arkansas and his colleagues noticed that gasters of many ants, the bulbous back end of the abdomen, were bright red, and the ants held them up high in a behavior called gaster flagging. Now, when the scientists dissected the ants, they found hundreds of tiny transparent eggs of a previously unknown species of a nematode worm. Now, the nematode infestation thinned the exoskeleton of the ant's gaster, which, combined with the presence of nematode eggs, caused it to look red and to detach easily from the rest of the ant's body. The gasters of these infested ants are easy pickings for local birds that usually eat red berries. Well, they kind of look like red berries kind of hanging around up there. And after the nematode eggs pass through the bird's digestive system, they are deposited back onto the forest floor in bird droppings. Gliding ants regularly eat bird droppings, and when worker ants bring the avian feces back to the nest, they inadvertently feed nematode eggs to ant larvae. As the ants develop, the nematodes grow and reproduce inside the ant's body, leaving eggs in the gaster. The ants trotter around until a bird picks them off, continuing the cycle. Some parasites even have more of a dramatic anatomical change in their victims. Now, the flatworm Leucochloridium paradoxum is a scourge of North American and European snails, unfortunate enough to eat the droppings of birds containing the eggs of the parasite. And we talked about this in one of the October issues of Savage Science Radio. And I remember this because once inside the snail's body, the worms infest the eye stalks, turning the tentacles into brightly colored pulsating organs that attract the birds. Once the bird eats this part of the infested snail, the parasites reproduce inside the bird and leave their eggs in its digestive system. Simple as they are, parasites have evolved to be masters of manipulation. Scientists are just beginning to study how two species come to occupy the same body and vie for its control. Now, it's not clear yet what chemical signals alter the behavior and appearance of parasitized ants and other victims. Somehow, fungi and other parasites are manipulating brain chemicals, and one doesn't have to be a mad scientist to want to understand more. Zombies have a long natural history stretching back tens of millions of years, and nature is filled with creeping, oozing, blood-sucking, and otherwise ghastly creatures just as terrifying as anything Hollywood could concoct. Just don't expect scientists to discover much about sparkling vampires or radioactive dinosaurs with a taste for Japanese cities anytime soon. And did I mention zombie cockroaches? Well, here's a little bit more about that particular species. Researchers have discovered how wasps' venom makes roaches into slaves. Researchers have worked out the neurological trick used by a species of wasp to turn cockroaches into zombie slaves. Now, this is getting a little bit more into the neurological part of what chemical signals that they were starting to research that we just talked about. The discovery explains why, once stung, cockroaches can be led by a much smaller master towards certain death. Researchers have proven their theory by replicating the effect and by using an anecdote injection to release the cockroaches from their zombie state. That's pretty cool and promising, just in case, you know, we might need something like that someday. Zombie insects might sound like the B-movie plot device from heaven or hell, depending on your cinematic preferences. But to the emerald cockroach wasp, Ampelix compressa, they're a tried and tested way to provide food for their hungry larvae. The wasp, which lives in tropical regions of Africa, India, and the Pacific Islands, relies on cockroaches for its grisly life cycle. But unlike many venomous predators, which paralyze their victims before eating them or dragging them back to their lair, the wasp's sting leaves the cockroach unable to walk, but unable to initiate its own movement. The wasp then grabs the cockroach's antenna and leads it back to the nest. The cockroach walks like a dog on a leash, says Frederick Liebersat of Ben Gurion University in the Negev in Israel, who led this research and has previously described the wasp's behavior in detail. Once home, the merciless wasp lays an egg on the docile cockroach's belly, and the larva, once hatched, devours the hapless insect. And you can see a video on this. Just look up wasp voodoo rituals and cockroach zombies in the French Polynesian Islands. I'm not joking, that's the name of the video. So anyway, in this toxic cocktail, but although the zombie cockroach phenomenon has been well documented, you know, obviously, Liebersat and his colleagues still didn't know how exactly the wasps pull off the trick. We know the wasp injects a rich cocktail of toxins, Liebersat says, but it was unclear how the venom could alter the victim's behavior so subtly. Now, the researchers knew that the wasps tend to sting the cockroaches once to subdue them and then administer another, more precise sting right to their victim's brain. So they suspected that the venom might work by blocking a key chemical messenger. Now, these results of their latest experiment published in the Journal of Experimental Biology support this theory. The researchers reported that the venom works to block a neurotransmitter called octopamine, which is involved in preparations to execute complex behaviors such as walking. Liebersat and his team found that they could restore spontaneous walking behavior in stung cockroaches by giving them a compound that reactivates octopamine receptors in the insect's central nervous system. This, they conclude, means that the wasp venom probably blocks these receptors. What's more, the researchers discovered that injecting unstung cockroaches with a compound that blocks these receptors produces a similar effect to that of the venom. And if you want to read more about that, you can look it up in Experimental Biology.
A company always on the run, a destiny, oh, it's the rising sun.
why they call me. Bad company, I'm a sinner.
And we actually have real science news in biology, the body and the brain. And we'll get to an interesting story about the brain in just a minute. But surgical center colonoscopies are stacking up. Colonoscopies performed at outpatient surgical centers are as safe as those done in hospitals, researchers at Emory University in Atlanta reported May 10th at the Digestive Disease Week meeting in Chicago. More than 174,000 Medicare records from 1992 to 2007 showed a 30-day compilation rate of 3.4% from hospital colonoscopies and 2.4% from those done in outpatient surgical centers. After accounting for differences among patients, these complication rates were similar. The share of colonoscopies done at hospitals fell from 69% to 47% over that span, while surgical centers saw an increase in colonoscopies from 10% to 48%. A shrinking number of the procedures are still done in doctor's offices. Now, the heart, morning attacks are the worst, as in heart attacks. A heart attack that strikes between 6 a.m. and noon does more damage than one that hits at any other time of the day. Scientists reported this in an upcoming issue of Heart. A research team in Spain analyzed data on 811 heart attacks and found that 269 had occurred in the morning, 240 between noon and 6 p.m., 161 from 6 to midnight, and 141 during the wee hours. Damage to the heart muscle was about 20% greater from the morning heart attacks than from those during the other times. Researchers say the findings call for further study into the role played by enzymes in the body that fluctuate with the body clock. And remembering dreams? Remember we did a review on Inception? Well, if you're worried about Leonardo DiCaprio planting thoughts into your dreams, certain types of brain activity may predict whether you'll be able to remember his attempts at Inception in the morning. People with just the right kind of brain pulses more frequently remember dreams when they wake up, a team of researchers in Italy reported in the May 4th issue of Journal of Neuroscience. Individuals are better able to recall their dreams if particular brain waves called theta waves are more active in the frontmost regions of the brain before waking from REM sleep. Similar brain patterns may help individuals remember events during the daytime, too. Very interesting. And speaking of dreams, mice act out in their dreams. You know, there's little doggy dreams. Well, I guess there's little mice dreams, too. Researchers have created a mouse version of a condition in which people physically act out their dreams. Unlike normal mice, who sleep peacefully curled up, mice with a particular neurological mutation thrash around during REM sleep, running, jerking, and chewing, researchers reported May 11th in the Journal of Neuroscience, also same journal. Most people with a similar condition known as REM sleep behavior disorder, or RBD, go on to develop Parkinson's or another dementia. So studying these mice in the lab might help scientists better understand the strange sleep disorder. Studies authors Patricia Brooks and John Peaver of the University of Toronto wrote. Now, the mice with the sleep disorder lack a working copy of a protein that detects nerve cell message is very interesting, and we'll keep an eye on that. I have that on my alert. Lung stem cells. Well, researchers have for the first time spotted tiny pockets of what look to be lung stem cells deep inside human respiratory tracts. These masters of disguise can form a wide variety of lung tissue in live animals, an international team of researchers reported online May 12th in the New England Journal of Medicine. As a test of versatility, the team injected the human stem cells into mice with damaged lungs. In about 2 weeks, the cells formed complex and seemingly functional respiratory structures in the mice, replacing about 30% of lost tissue. And just what if you had to rebuild a brain? Well, Team Frankenstein is launching a bid to build a human brain within a decade. Oh yeah. A team of scientists have assembled in Switzerland and Germany to pursue a unique goal, the building of a computer model of a human brain. It's called the Human Brain Project, okay, but perhaps inevitably dubbed Team Frankenstein in the media, is in discussion with the EU for about a £1 billion grant. Scientists claim success may lead to cures for various diseases like Parkinson's, we were just talking about. It could also lead to intelligent robots and supercomputers, which would dwarf those currently in existence. Henry Markram, a neuroscientist at the École Polytechnique Fédérale in Lausanne, Switzerland, has assembled a team of 9 top European scientists for the research effort. This is one of the 3 grand challenges for humanity. We need to understand Earth, space, and the brain. We need to understand what makes us human, Markram told Germany's Spiegel magazine. The scientists and researchers working with the Human Brain Project believe that if they secure this funding, they will be able to replicate mankind's most vital organ in 12 years. The applications for if it is successful are enormous. Drug companies, for instance, would be able to dramatically shorten testing times by bypassing humans to test new medicaments on the computer model. Now, supercomputers at the Jülich Research Center near Cologne are earmarked to play a vital role in the research, which Markram says will involve a tsunami of data. Jülich neuroscientist Katrina Munz has begun work on a detailed atlas of the brain, which involved slicing one into 8,000 parts, which were then digitalized into a scanner. Now, Markram added, it's not impossible to build a human brain. We can do it in just over 10 years. This will, when successful, help 2 billion people annually who suffer from some type of brain impairment. Now, this project has already created an artificial neocortical column, which is unique to mammals. We have many of these columns to cope with complex cognitive functions, including parenthood and social interactions. It was digitally constructed using a software model of tens of thousands of neurons. And again, that's called the Human Brain Project for people who want to keep an eye out for that. And we will bring any late-breaking information about their work to you on this show. Now, about those tips we were telling you about with the zombies. Well, obviously, the most important thing is to get rid of the head because of the whole brain problem. Now, if you want to look to more of the academic or written word, you can always go for the ever-popular Zombie Survival Guide, which is found, I saw it in Barnes & Noble, so I know it's got to be pretty much everywhere. Remember 2009 Robert Smith? Well, he, of course, published his paper in his book about infectious disease modeling called When Zombies Attack, Mathematical Modeling of an Outbreak of Zombie Infection. It's also available in PDF. It started out as a class project, and then they suggested the model of the zombies in his disease modeling class would be a great idea. And he was interviewed on NPR, so if you want to look that up, that's something interesting. And we had talked about Robert Smith before. That paper sparked further research in the latest contribution, Zombies in the City, a Net Logo Model, which is also PDF, will appear in the upcoming book, Mathematical Modeling of Zombies. And in this new study, an epidemiologist and a mathematician at Australian National University refined the initial model and incorporate the higher speed of humans and our capacity to increase our skills through experience. They conclude that only when human skill levels are very low do the zombies have a chance of winning, while only human skill levels In high human skill levels ensure human victory. Yeah, if you're a slow mover and you don't have a weapon, you're probably going to get zombieized. Then, of course, we talked about Stephen Schlossman, and his book was called The Zombie Autopsy, Secret Notebooks from the Apocalypse. And there's also some interesting theories in case you've got, you know, 4 or 5 years holed up in the mall or your home or someplace where the zombies aren't going to get to you and you've got plenty of food. Well, guess what? Deborah Bloom, at Speakeasy Science, has come up with 5 scientific reasons a zombie apocalypse could happen, and you can read about those, including brain parasites, neurotoxins, and nanobots. Yes, nanobots. That's pretty interesting. And here's something that's kind of fun. If you go on Zombie Science 1Z, the website, which is available at a browser near you for free. It's a guy who does British Science and Fringe Festivals. He's a zombieologist, Dr. Austin, ZITSMSZBSZDPEP are his credentials. Lectures in 3 modules, Zombieism Condition, The Cause of Zombieism, and The Prevention and Curing of Zombieism, which are all available right on his website, Zombie Science 1Z. And there's a textbook and online exam, as a matter of fact. And don't forget, the Zombie Research Society keeps track of all of this and more and promotes Zombie Scholarship and Zombie Awareness Month. Their slogan, "What you don't know can eat you." Which are words of wisdom that probably the ants, cockroaches, and snails we talked about earlier could have used a couple million years ago. Anyway, well, if we are still around next week and we're not all zombified, we will bring you another edition of Savage Science Radio. If not, it's been nice knowing you. I'll keep on broadcasting until everybody at the station turns into zombies. They're far away, though, so they can't get me. I'll be holed up in my house. Anyway, I would like to thank Nick Palucco for the great show graphics and Dennis Bond and Hawk Productions for that wonderful intro that I use every week. I would like to thank Waleed Al-Haddad for helping me find fantastic stories to bring to you, and the excellent Todd Sheets, who is my executive producer and helps make this show what it is. So, until next we meet again, keep your powder and your pants dry, and happy trails to you. And hopefully we will be meeting again. Bye.
Do you feel that? Oh, shit. Wah-ah-ah-ah. Get up, come on, get down with the sickness. Get up, come on, get down with the sickness. Get up, come on, get down with the sickness. Open up your hands.